I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Imagine parachuting from 19 miles above the Earth, from the edge of space. Central Florida resident Joe Kittinger did that 51 years ago next week. On August 16, 1960, he flew a balloon to where the sky meets space and jumped. At his fastest, he fell more than 600 miles an hour. His record for highest parachute jump remains unbroken. Kittinger's jump tested a high-altitude escape system for astronauts. His adventures didn't end there. Kittinger served three tours in Vietnam as a combat pilot. He was shot down and held as a POW. Kittinger also was the first person to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean in a helium balloon. Ahead on Intersection, Joe Kittinger talks about his adventures. And I'm joined by Joe Kittinger, retired Air Force colonel who holds the record for the highest parachute jump. He lives in the Orlando area, and we're taping today. It's his birthday. You're 83.
Yes, 83.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on this special day.
Delighted to be here, Mark.
Well, Joe, your jump in 1960 was part of an Air Force research project using high-altitude balloons to determine an escape system for astronauts if anything should go wrong during their own flights. What were researchers trying to determine from your jump?
Well, we really had two objectives. The first objective, no one had ever been in space before, and we knew that when we went into space, we were going to have to get outside of the spacecraft. So we wanted to do research on how to protect a man outside of a spacecraft. That was one objective. And the other objective was we had a lot of very high-flying aircraft flying up in that 20 miles above the Earth, and we didn't really have a way to get them back safely. And the purpose of this program was to come up with a way of escape, providing escape from very high altitudes. I made a total of three jumps, two jumps in preparation for the final jump, and we came up with a multi-stage parachute that worked. And here now, some 51 years later, it's still being used all over the whole world. Every ejection system in the world used a small stabilization parachute that we developed back in 1959, 1960 for this program. So what we did back 51 years ago is still being used today, which makes us all very proud that we did contribute to our country.
And when you talk about the high-flying aircraft, not just astronauts, some of the spy planes and fighter jets of those eras were really pushing the envelope in terms of altitude.
Well, yes, we had a 104 fighter, Starfighter, went over 100,000 feet. We had SR-71 Blackbirds and U-2s and a lot of airplanes flying up there very high. But this system that we developed is good also down at low altitudes. So it encompasses all the way, the whole variety of altitudes, and usable with a variety of different aircraft.
So take me back to 1960 when you're getting ready for this jump, which was part of, was it Project Manhigh?
No, it was Project Excelsior.
Okay.
Project Manhigh was a program I did in 1957 where I went up in a pressurized capsule to 97,000 feet, which was really considered the first space flight. Because I was in a space environment, in a spacecraft, and even though it was lifted by a balloon, it was still the hostile region of space. But the program was called Excelsior. And as I pointed out, this was my third jump. It was done from New Mexico. We took off about 6 o'clock in the morning. It took an hour and a half to get up to altitude. And at about 40,000 feet, I discovered that my pressure suit glove on my right hand was not working. And I was faced with a dilemma. If I told the people on the ground, I knew they would make me abort the flight. So I opted not to tell them. I went ahead and flew with my pressure suit glove not working.
And what does that mean? What happens when that's not working?
Well, when it's not working, the lack of pressure, you're in a vacuum, and your hand swells up to twice its normal size, and it's rather painful, and you can't use it. And it's all of that is prevented if you have pressurization, but no pressurization. I could not use my right hand. But I took a calculated risk to go ahead and do it without telling the people on the ground. And everything we designed we could use either hand, right or left hand. So I was able to do the jump without using my right hand.
Why not tell them and try to make another go at it?
Well, because it was a very low-budget program, and I wasn't certain we'd get the money to do it if we aborted that flight. And I felt it was very important they would get the information, so I opted not to tell them on the ground, because they would have made me abort the flight if I would have told them.
So
that was a conscious decision on my part not to tell them. So I get to 102,800 feet, and I drift for 11 minutes while the balloon gets over exactly the right spot. And then I said a prayer and hit the button to start the cameras running and jumped.
Now, what were you thinking when you're up there floating around in this upper level of the atmosphere?
Well, first of all, it's very beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. You can see for 500 miles. You can up overhead is absolutely black, and you can see the world from a very high angle. But it's very hostile. Space is hostile to man, and without the elaborate protection against the vacuum of space, you die very quickly. It's 100 degrees below zero, which is very cold. So it's beautiful, but it's hostile. And, of course, I was there as a test pilot. I was there to gather information that we needed for the program. So I was extremely busy. I was flying the balloon and communicating with the ground, and I was very busy. And when it came time to go, I didn't hesitate at all. I had been trained to do it. I was a test pilot, and I was there to make the jump. And I had confidence in myself and confidence in my equipment and confidence in my team. So when it came time to go, I was ready to go.
So were you thinking, you know, this is going to be a historic moment, or no sense of fear, nothing like that?
No, I was a test pilot, and I was here to accomplish a mission. I was there to gather information, gather data. And to me, it was by training. I was highly trained, highly motivated, and I had made the decision to go there way before I got there.
Was there still in the back of your mind, though, that this was a risky thing to be doing?
Well, it had never been done before. You know, when you're doing something that's never been done before, there's always some question in your mind. But I had confidence that we could make it. But I knew it was risky because it had never been done before. The second time you do something like that, it's much easier because you've already demonstrated you can do it. So there is that risk.
And I remember reading in some of the stories about your experience, the extremes of temperatures up there are very great, whether or not you're facing the sun or away from the sun. Can you describe that?
Well, as I said, it's 100 degrees below zero. You're in a vacuum. It's extremely bright. There's nothing to reflect. To take away the sun rays. So it's extremely bright, requiring a real elaborate visors to protect your eyes up there. But it's beautiful but hostile.
When you made that jump, what did you experience?
Well, first of all, I fell for 4 minutes and 36 seconds. I was extremely busy. I was describing how my parachute was working. I was manipulating my body so that I could go different directions. I was working, checking out the pressure suit, my mobility. I was there as a test pilot. I was there to gather information that we needed, that we were there for. So I was extremely busy and falling very, very rapidly. I reached about 614 miles an hour and then at about 90,000 feet, and from then on, I constantly slowed down because the density was increasing as I fell. And the parachute opened at about 14,000 feet, and from then once the main parachute opened, then the rest of the jump was rather anticlimactic.
Wow, I don't know if there could be really such a thing as that being anticlimactic, but I'll take your word for it. How fast did those 4 minutes go by when you're in that free fall?
It went by extremely fast. I had an altimeter and a stopwatch on my left wrist. And just before I jumped, I started the stopwatch going. And we had computed it would take 4 minutes and 37 seconds. It actually took 4 minutes and 36 seconds. So we were extremely close on what we had planned for the free fall. But I was very busy during that time.
Now, did you break the sound barrier when you were coming down?
I approached it, but I don't believe I broke it. I approached it.
Were you conscious of the speed? Were you able to somehow gauge your speed if you were getting close to that point?
No, because there's nothing there for you to focus on. You know you're going very fast. When I first jumped, I looked up and I saw the balloon that was firing into space. And then I realized the balloon was standing still, and I was going down at a very fast rate. But once I got in free fall, after a couple of minutes, there's nothing there to judge your speed at all, except the altimeter unwinding as it was. So there's no way to really tell what altitude you're at except for the altimeter.
And you get that training as a pilot to believe in your instruments. Don't necessarily trust your senses because your sense of orientation can be very flummoxed.
Well, I had three ways to determine. First of all, I had an altimeter that told me where I was. I had a stopwatch that I knew how far we were going to fall. And then I had an aneroid that would open my parachute automatically if something happened. But you're right. Pilots and test pilots are used to flying their instruments and trusting them.
Now, this was, you know, information that was going to go into the space program. There were still a lot of unknowns. And I wonder, were there concerns about cosmic rays, cosmic radiation being so high in the atmosphere, so thin, you didn't have that protective layer of gases?
Cosmic radiation was a question. But remember, I had done a flight in 1957 up to 97,000 feet. And one of the objectives of that was to determine how of a danger was cosmic radiation. And consensus was that we could do the thing fairly safely because of the cosmic radiation is not that much of a threat at that altitude.
Did you ever experience any ill effects from having either been at such high altitudes or having your pressure suit malfunction or just making those jumps at all?
No. No, and you know, I'd been up in the altitude chamber 100 times to 100,000 feet, so I was very used to being at low pressures and altitude chambers. So no ill effects. And just like the astronauts that work outside the space shuttle, they've been doing that for 30 years and without any ill effects.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm talking with Joe Kittinger. He's a retired Air Force colonel who holds the record for the highest parachute jump. He lives in the Orlando area. I'm Mark Simpson. Are you interested in space? What about skydiving? Any experience there? You can tell us about it on the WMFE Facebook and Twitter pages, or you can send email to intersection@WMFE.org. Now, when you made that record-breaking jump, as you've said, this was not your first high-altitude jump. But during previous training exercises, you did have some technical difficulties where a cord got wrapped around you. You ended up going into a flat spin. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we were there to prevent the flat spin. And on my first jump from 76,000 feet, I had a problem getting out of the seat. And as a result, my timer started working on my small stabilization chute before I really wanted it to. And when I jumped, instead of free-falling for 16 seconds before the small parachute opened up, I only fell for 2.5 seconds. And the parachute came out and, lacking sufficient velocity, wrapped around my neck. So I made the jump without any stabilization. I made the jump that we knew was going to be hazardous because of the spinning that we'd encountered with our dummies that we had dropped. And I'd made several free falls. I was a trained skydiver. But I started turning to the left, and I started turning to the right, and I stopped it. And then I had a violent spin to the left, and it was so violent I couldn't pull my arms in. And I became unconscious, and I stayed unconscious until my reserve parachute opened. So it was a very hairy experience. Even though we didn't plan it, we demonstrated why we needed to do our project. We demonstrated that without stabilization, that a pilot would spin violently. So it really justified why we were there to do the test. So even though we didn't plan it, it ended up demonstrating why we were there for the test.
And was this to test what would happen if a pilot went into a flat spin or a plane? What were you looking to try to solve?
Well, if a man escaped from high altitude, without a small stabilization parachute, he's going to spin. And we were there to prevent it from that happening.
And what are the effects that can happen to a pilot?
Well, it can kill him. In my case, I had 120 RPM that I was spinning at. It made me unconscious. At about 180 RPM, you can get brain damage. And you can actually die from the centrifugal force, prolonged exposure to centrifugal force.
Do you ever hang on to any memorabilia from any of these historic jumps?
Yes, I have some mementos from it. Because that was the most exciting thing in my life, was that jump. And I visualize it just as vivid today as it was 51 years ago.
I wondered about that because it was many decades ago. It's still very fresh in your mind.
Very fresh in my mind. And it was 51 years ago on the 16th of August.
I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about the era in which you were doing this. In the 1960s, it was still the dawn of jet planes and space travel. And I wonder, what was the mood back then? Was there a sense that you were going into unknown realms and you were going in brand new territory, breaking ground?
Yes, it was brand new territory. I worked for a man by the name of Dr. John Paul Stapp, and he was a visionary. He knew we were going to go into space. He knew there were certain things that we needed to determine before we went into space. There was a funny attitude about space. A lot of people figured we'd never go there. They thought it was Buck Rogers. And there was a lot of people that were resistant with it. But fortunately, I worked for a visionary, a man that knew we were going to go there. Sputnik had not happened. Sputnik didn't happen until a year later. So the space age had really not started. This was the beginning. This was before the space age. Getting information that we knew that we would have to have to go into space. What we learned on our programs helped NASA when it came time to develop the Mercury program. It helped NASA when it came time for people to get outside of the spacecraft. So we made a contribution to the space age that was coming very soon.
Now, was this top secret stuff?
No, it wasn't secret, but we didn't publicize it. I always felt it was better to talk about what you've done rather than what you're going to do. And so we never broadcast what we were going to do. After we'd done it, then we sold what we had done.
You know, Tom Wolfe wrote the book The Right Stuff, and it tracks the achievements of the Mercury 7 astronauts as well as famous test pilots like Chuck Yeager. And in the film, The Right Stuff, it kind of gets the feeling that while the astronauts got a lot of the glory, so much work was done by unheralded test pilots, people like yourself, people like Chuck Yeager, doing things behind the scenes. Do you feel that that's accurate?
Well, of course. There was 1,000 people that contributed to every flight. There was work that was started back in the 20s on aerospace medicine. There was work that was done on aeronautics and rocket propulsion over the last 50 years before then. So they were the fortunate people that got to be on the shoulders of people that put them there. But all of us that were involved with it, we're just delighted we had the opportunity to contribute. There was never any envy about the success or the notoriety that they got, because we were fortunate we had an opportunity to contribute ourselves.
I'm talking with legendary test pilot Joe Kittinger. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE FM. I'm Mark Simpson. You knew so many of the astronauts in those famous programs in the early days of manned space exploration. You were so close to it. How come not the astronaut corps for you?
Well, I had an opportunity to volunteer for the astronaut program, and I think I'd have been selected. But I was very much involved in research that I knew was needed. And if I would have gotten out, it would have taken another couple of years to get that information. So I made a conscious decision not to apply for it. I think I'd had a good chance, but I never regretted it because I had an opportunity to make a contribution. And really, in life, you never look back and say, I should have done this, I should have done that. You have to accept what you did. But I never regretted my road that I took.
Were there other test pilots who had to face a similar choice?
All of them. All the test pilots did. And there was, at the beginning of the Mercury program, there was a lot of pilots that were very hesitant to volunteer for that program because originally there was too much emphasis being put on chimpanzees and monkeys. And
ham the monkey.
The
right.
Test pilots didn't want to be associated with a program that a chimpanzee could do it. But here's what happened. When the Mercury program was started, the pilot had about 10% to help on the mission. But by the time the pilots got in there and they saw what the pilots could do, it ended up with the pilots had 90% of the mission. because of the intellect and the decision-making capability that a man can do that a computer can never do or an ape could never do. So they found out in the Mercury program that a man was a very, very important part to get the job done safely and correctly. And that's manifested itself through all the rest of the programs. Man is needed. Man can make decisions, can evaluate what's going on quicker than any other mechanism that there is.
Talk to me about that, because I think that's so interesting. You know, I've had the opportunity to speak to some folks involved in the shuttle program, launch directors, and those sorts of folks, of people. And so much of that is computerized, but there is still that human element at the very top of the pyramid waiting to make those decisions. Do you think, are we approaching the moment when that's ever going to get phased out?
I think you're always going to be sitting there monitoring the computers. When a man's involved and a man's life is involved, I think you have to go to the ultimate in making certain it's done as safely and as efficiently as possible. I think it'll be a long time before we will allow the computer to make all the decisions. I think man will always be involved somewhere in the decision-making process.
After your record-breaking jumps and deciding against joining the astronaut corps, you instead became a combat pilot in Vietnam. Why did you decide to do that?
I was a fighter pilot, and I was a test pilot. And a small country in Southeast Asia, South Vietnam, was being invaded by a communist nation. And I felt that I should support my Air Force and my country and to help that small country. So I volunteered to go to the air commandos because I felt as a fighter pilot that that's what I should be doing. And I never regretted that decision. There was a lot of us who went to Vietnam because we were trying to prevent that country from being overtaken. Unfortunately, we lost that, but it wasn't because of the military, it was because of the politicians. But the reason why we were there was a valid reason. And I volunteered to go over there to fight against a communist enemy.
And what were you in when you were shot down?
I was in an F-4 Phantom, about 30 miles northwest of Hanoi.
What do you remember from that experience, from the actual
experience? Well, it was the worst day of my life, obviously. I was flying along in a beautiful F-4 Mach 2 chasing a MiG, and all of a sudden I get shot down. And I'm flying 1 minute at Mach 2 in a beautiful airplane, and the next minute I'm in a parachute coming down 30 miles northwest of Hanoi. And so it went from an interesting day to a miserable day coming down in an enemy area. And I was, as soon as I landed, I was immediately surrounded by about 100 farmers and taken immediately to Hanoi. So it was the worst day of my life to end up to be a POW.
And you eventually ended up at the Hanoi Hilton, where many other American POWs were held, including John McCain.
Yes, there were about 550 POWs in four different camps. There was about 180 people in the camp I was at. I was in actually downtown Hanoi. We called it the Hilton. Jokingly, we called it the Hilton. But John McCain was one of the POWs there, and I used to talk with him in the courtyard.
What did you talk about?
Freedom, how much we loved our country, what our religion meant to us. We had very interesting conversations.
What did religion mean to you in that time?
Well, it was vital. It was being a Christian gave you hope. It was something that was a great foundation that helped me. An interesting story is when I joined the Air Force, just before I left, my mother gave me the 23rd Psalm. And she said, I would like for you to memorize this. And I said, Mother, I don't want to do that. She said, well, I'm asking you as a favor to me. I want you to memorize the 23rd Psalm. So my mother asked me very few things to do, so I did that. I memorized it because she said, you might need it someday. Well, 27 years later, I'm a POW, and I'm sitting there, and I'm in very bad shape. I had a very severe wound. I'm being tortured. I'm very thirsty, very hungry. I was really at the very, very low ebbs. And all of a sudden, I remembered that 23rd Psalm that my mother had insisted that I memorize. And it was a very profound moment in my life that something that she had insisted that I do that meant so much to me at that moment in time. And it gave me strength. It gave me the reason to continue on. And it was a great, great benefit, a morale booster for me that when I suddenly remembered that 23rd Psalm. But religion meant an awful lot to all of us in that. We had church services every Sunday. If there was one guy in the room or 20, we'd have a church service every Sunday. We would sing all the hymns that we knew, but nobody knew the second hymn of any hymn. So we all sang three or four songs that we just knew the first verse of. We sang the first verse five times. But to us, it was just as important as being able to have all the hymns that we could sing.
Did you have a sense of time when you were being held as a prisoner?
Every day is a blessing when you get finished with the day. Yes, it was. Time went very slowly. They gave us nothing to read. We had no stimuli like that. One time, one of the guards asked me, the interrogator asked me, "Would you like to have a book?" I said, "Of course I would." He said, "Well, if you had one book, what book would you like to have?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to have a Bible." And the interrogator said, "You know, that's amazing. Every American, that's the book he wants." And, "Well, you'll never understand it, but that's right. That's the book we want." But anyway, they had no stimuli. They gave us nothing to read, so we had to entertain ourselves. We had to we had classes every day in geography and agriculture and architecture and poems and trips and movies, and we would sit there and entertain each other because we had no other stimuli.
Did you ever get that Bible?
No. They knew that the Bible would give us comfort, so they didn't give it to us. They did that on purpose, of course.
Well, how did you get out of the Hanoi Hilton eventually?
Well, the Paris Peace Accords were signed in January 1973, and all of the POWs were released as a result of the Paris Peace Accords.
And how long?
I was asked to release for 1973.
After how long?
11 months.
You know, today we're almost in an age of information saturation. So much is known about the Earth and its environments. Where do you see the next frontiers for this new century?
Go to Mars with a man. To me, that's going to be the great 21st century adventure. Let's go to Mars. First planet. Man, first man on a planet. It's going to be a challenge.
Joe, thanks for coming and sharing those stories.
Mark, I must tell you that you've really done your homework. I always enjoy working with professionals. And frequently, when I have interviews, people have not done the homework. And I really appreciate the fact that you have. And that means an awful lot to a person like me that gets to be interviewed, that the guy thought enough of the opportunity to do the research. You did that. Thanks a lot.
There's a lot more to our interview with Joe Kittinger online. Hear Joe's record-breaking adventure crossing the Atlantic Ocean solo, what his favorite plane is, about his new book, and what it means to have an Orlando park dedicated in his name. Plus, you can see a video of Kittinger's record-breaking 1960 jump. It's online at WMFE.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.